I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Mark Laurie and Vinny Barrara, co-founders of Diapers.com, the online retail site specializing in baby products. Mark and Vinny started Diapers.com in 2005, and Amazon bought the parent company Quitsy for $540 million in 2010. Quitsy also owns other e-commerce sites, including Soap.com, focused on cleaning supplies, Wag.com, focused on pet products, and Yoyo.com, specializing in toys. Quitsy is based in Jersey City, New Jersey. Welcome.
Thank you.
You both grew up in New Jersey, and you met each other for the first time as friends in elementary school. What appealed to you about each other?
We met in when we were 10 years old in fifth grade, and I think early on we were both big Yankee fans and both into sports, like playing sports, any sport basically, and so I think that was one of the first things that definitely connected us.
I think when Mark first came, by the way, he came in, I was at that school beforehand. And I remember, you know, coming in from Staten Island. So this school was in Tinton Falls by the Jersey Shore. And Mark was always a little bit different, or started out different. He was this brash kid, you know, definitely an athlete. He had a lot of spunk, and I was more shy and introverted. So I don't know, in those early years, we were friends, but I think we became much closer.
Yeah, as the years went on.
Yeah,
right?
In high school. And then after that, you know, we did a lot of stuff together. We studied abroad. We lived together in New York for a year. We were each other's, you know, best men at each other's weddings. So very close.
At what point did you first start talking about building a business together?
I think it was probably in 1999. I was a banker at the time, making, you know, very good money. I was on a great career path. He was a lawyer, same thing, situation there. And we just asked ourselves, do we want to be doing this for the next 30, 40 years?
Yeah, you did have a diverse professional life before starting your first company together. Mark, as you mentioned, you were an investment banker. And you, Vinny, you were a lawyer. And you helped to draft the distribution plan for the $1.25 billion settlement, which was a class action lawsuit initiated by the victims of the Holocaust against the Swiss banks. Can you talk briefly about that case and that experience?
Yeah, that was great. I had started, as you mentioned, as a litigator at a large firm and then went to a smaller firm, and I was given the opportunity to work on a team of four or five lawyers recommending a plan to the judge to figure out how to distribute this pool of money, which might seem like a lot, $1.25 billion, but actually was quite small in the scheme of things given the number of victims. And so, you know, we were trying to do that in a way which fit the law, but at the same time also trying to figure out a way that we would do this in a manner that was fair and equitable and would have meaning to the victims, because given the fact there were so many, the last thing we wanted to do was give, you know, $5 or something small to each person. Our recommendation was to give the majority of the proceeds to the folks in Eastern Europe who we thought had suffered quite a bit and hadn't gotten, through some of the other cases, most of the proceeds. So it was a great experience.
Were you feeling the same professionally as Mark was when you decided, you know what, let's start a company together? Like, what was your state of mind at the time?
Yeah, it was, you know, as Mark mentioned, it was the late 90s. It was the internet heyday. We actually had another friend that was one of our co-founders, and I was single at the time. And thought, you know, this was just a great opportunity to take a risk, be able to work with your best friends, and take a shot at a business we thought, you know, made sense. And so I don't know how much thinking, quite frankly. I think I was 28 years old or something. We were a little bit spontaneous.
We didn't take a salary or anything. It was pretty rash decision.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So this company that you first started was ThePit.com, and it was an online collectibles stock market for, let's say, trading sports cards. And you mentioned before your interest in baseball. You're both avid Yankee fans. The company was sold to Topps, where you both were working. I guess there was an agreement when the company was bought, you had to work there. At what point did the idea for Diapers.com originate?
I think the idea probably started around 2003. Mm-hmm. I think. So it was a couple of years before we actually launched it. We started talking about it, thinking about it.
One thing was funny is I remember I had just gotten married, as Mark said, in 2003, and I went on my honeymoon, and I think the day I got back, Mark had called me and said, I got something. I got an idea. I want to go buy this domain name 1-800-DIAPERS. Actually, I want to go buy the phone number, I think, 1-800-DIAPERS. I don't remember, it was 5 grand or something.
Yeah, 5 grand.
And you would actually, at my, I think, wedding night.
On the bus.
On the
wedding
bus. On the party bus.
I was throwing it out there.
You were throwing it out there to all of my friends. We thought you were crazy. So I was ruminating, you know, during my wedding honeymoon. So when we came back, because I recall at the end of, you know, in 03 is when we actually did it. We bought the domain name in October of 2003.
1-800-diapers.com.
That's right.
We couldn't afford diapers.com at the time.
Yeah.
How much was it at the time?
I mean, it was hundreds of thousands, maybe even a million. We didn't actually look even into it. It was so expensive at that time.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Mark Laurie and Vineet Barrara, co-founders of the e-commerce company Diapers.com. The company sells more than 40,000 baby products and was sold to Amazon in 2010. Diapers.com, it's an online retail site for all the types of baby supplies, but it is logistically very intensive. It's very exacting supply inventory system and shipping operations and customer service. And you need, you know, real efficiencies in order to be able to make money from essentially commodities. Can you describe what your warehouse looks like?
Sure. We have three different warehouses. Each of them fully equipped with robots. The robots actually do and fetch all the product and bring it back to a picking station where somebody who's standing stationary picks from the shelves that were brought to them from these robots. You know, on the right side and left side of this picker, there might be four or five empty brown boxes that were brought there by robots. And so based on what people order and knowing the sizes of the order, we have an algorithm that will go through and sort of fit it into the smallest box possible, like a little Rubik's Cube. And so the person will just see it says make box 3. And then when the box is full, a light flashes and says, now you've picked everything for this box. You hit the button and the robot will then take the box to a place where it gets taped and dunnage. You know, the plastic stuff goes in there to protect it. And then it'll get automatically on conveyor put into whatever UPS, FedEx, or other truck that's waiting at one of the bays. So as you said, we built all our own proprietary technology, all our own inventory systems, all our own supply chain systems, this boxing software, all the things that we needed to do to squeeze every penny out of the supply chain. Because as you said, the commodity goods.
How many robots are in each warehouse, roughly?
I don't know the exact number, but there are hundreds of robots.
And what do they look like?
They're basically about maybe a foot high off the ground and maybe 4 feet long by 3 feet wide, and capable of carrying thousands of pounds. There's like highways, digital highways, throughout the entire warehouse that these robots are reading in order to know how to get to where they need to go.
How did you know how to build all this specialized software? Because you certainly didn't come from the logistics business prior.
Well, we were fortunate that in our previous business, The Pit, we had a chief technology officer named Wei Yan, and we enlisted him early on to do all of our development and software programming, gave him some equity, because in the beginning we actually worked nights and weekends and hadn't quit our jobs. So he was a mainstay in terms of doing all the technology.
Now, you know, we talk about how efficient and high-tech this whole system is, but it didn't always look this squeaky clean. You started off in a very ad hoc manner. Can you talk about the early days when you just had launched 1-800-diapers.com? What did it look like?
Well, in the very early days, we actually didn't even have boxes. We actually had someone, a stay-at-home mom, that we hired to do the fulfillment and the customer service. So she would use Vonage. I don't know if you know that phone system. That would be our customer service.
This is Gina DePaola?
Yes, Gina.
Okay.
Gina. So she would use Vonage to answer the calls, and she was the only rep. And so there would be times, you know, it took off a little bit in the beginning, and customers would call, and the customer would say, hey, can I speak to your supervisor? And, of course, there was no supervisor. She would say, hang on a second. And then she'd take a second, and she'd come back and disguise her voice and you know, do a high-pitched voice, and she'd be the supervisor. So it was, and again, and
that's
also
a true story.
Yeah, and she would do this out of her garage. And
she was a college friend of yours, Mark.
College friend of my wife's.
Of your wife's, yeah.
Yeah, so she was doing this out of her garage in Long Island. And the other thing was that basically she was storing these cases of diapers on her lawn. And so there was this whole issue anytime it'd rain or anything like that, what do you do? And the tarp and her dad, it was crazy,
yeah.
Right? So those early days, we didn't have the logistics. As I said, we didn't even have box. We'd strap the diapers and the wipes together with rope, basically.
Yeah,
right?
Things were moving so fast in the early stages that seriously, we didn't even think about things like rain. And it was just put it out on the lawn, you know, until we got the call.
Did you just partner with, let's say, you know, these large diaper suppliers and baby products companies?
Venturi? No, this is really funny. No, we Procter & Gamble and Kimberly-Clark, which are the two biggest diaper manufacturers, they weren't able to sell us directly, or they didn't want to sell us directly for the first 2 years of the business. So we had to buy the product from BJ's Wholesale Club. You had to physically go into the store and put it on your credit card and pay for it. And in the beginning, it was fine. But it got to the point where one BJ's wasn't enough to satisfy our demand. We'd have to go to like four, five, six, seven BJ's and clean them out completely. But it was a long time before we were actually able to buy direct.
Yeah, our parents, we would use the parents' credit cards. So my dad, you know, Indian-American, is a sort of, it's actually just Indian, I should say, huge accent, would be going into these BJ's and would be ordering something like $80,000 worth of product. And these, but it was done in this odd thing where it was sort of done, yeah, not in the back room, it was almost like he was standing at the counter. And this receipt would come out, it'd be like 10 feet long, you know, $80,000 of it. He'd call me like, I don't know, son, I got 200 BJ's size 3 Pampers. And we'd be like double checking this whole thing. And it was crazy. And your dad too would be going.
Oh yeah, my dad would go in.
We were just using any credit card we could, basically.
So you essentially were cash flow positive. You were getting a lot of cash from customers.
Oh yeah, it was perfect. We had no working capital. It was negative working capital. Yeah, we were getting paid in 2 days and didn't have to pay for it for 30 days. That's what kept us going. That's how we financed the business in large part. But unfortunately, it meant losing like $5, $6 every box we sold. So those losses started to add up, too.
So here you are. You're hemorrhaging money. And you know that because these are basically commodities, it's very hard to make a profit selling online. So what was your ultimate belief about the company?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the strategy early on we recognized was all about, first, a mission to make mom's life easier. So that meant, you know, overnight or two-day shipping. You know, 77% of the country now is getting overnight, even some of it same day. So super fast delivery with a really top-notch customer service experience. So 365-day return policy, no questions at all. We have all customer service staff in our corporate office with us. We felt like if we can ship the stuff fast, at good prices, with great customer service and a really wide assortment, that this is something that could make mom's life easier. And then they'd sort of come back to the site over and over again. And we'd, from then, be able to sell them, hopefully, everything else that they might need.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Mark Lorre and Vinny Barrara, co-founders of Diapers.com. We'll hear more from Mark and Vinny coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Mark Lorre and Vinny Barrara, co-founders of Diapers.com, the online retail site specializing in baby products. Mark and Vinny started Diapers.com in 2005, and Amazon bought the parent company, Quitsy, for $540 million in 2010. Quitsy also owns other e-commerce sites, including Soap.com, focused on cleaning supplies, Wag.com, focused on pet products, and Yoyo.com, specializing in toys. Quitsy is based in Jersey City, New Jersey. So this was the ultimate vision, but while you were in the weeds, losing money, hardly had boxes, did not have the high-tech systems in place, was there a turning point at some point where you're like, wow, you know what, this is actually starting to work?
Yeah. Well, really early on, in the first 4 months, five months after we launched, it was a small... I remember I was traveling with my wife, and we were visiting her alma mater, Georgetown, and it was a Saturday morning, and you know, we weren't doing that many orders, and we had a back end system where you could check, you know, how many orders were being fulfilled by Gina. And I remember going to the library, Georgetown Library, and going logging into the system, and I saw, whoa, there were something like 200 orders that morning, or 250 orders, which for us at the time was a lot. Parenting magazine had found out about us and had, just in a one sentence blurb, mentioned us. And with that very small mention on some, you know, page 37 of the magazine, a lot of people responded. And so I think we saw there that there was some kind of connection we were establishing with customers, even as we didn't have all the logistics set. I think we knew that we had something. Mm-hmm. It did then take, you know, another 12 months before we quit our jobs in the summer of 2006, before we got our act together and figured out, you know, how we were going to go raise money and write a business plan. But I think within those first few months, we saw that the customers were telling us that they liked what we were doing.
There was a need,
and nobody was doing it, right? Because mm-hmm. To your point earlier, you know, it's very difficult to do it in any kind of way that generates any type of return.
What was your family life like at the time? You had just recently gotten married, but any kids in the picture?
I had my first kid in 2000 and the second kid in 2003. So in 2005, I had two little kids, basically.
And I got married in 2003 when the idea was born, but in 2005, my first child was born. So within a few months of launch, my first child was born, so we were able to use the service.
Oh, I heard somewhere one of you used cloth diapers and had trouble finding cloth diapers. Is that a myth?
I think that's a myth.
Yeah.
We didn't use cloth diapers.
So you are the role model for, you know, successfully scaling a specialized commodity business, but other companies before you have failed. There's, you know, Pet.com, which is mm-hmm. like the poster child of failure and from the internet era. Why do you think, what did you do well that other companies before you did not do well, do you think?
I think first, we had a very long-term strategy. And that long-term strategy was predicated on building relationship with the commodity consumables, recognizing that we weren't going to make money on those consumables, that we would make money on off the relationship and selling the high-margin goods. So it was a long-term strategy that required a lot of capital. So, you know, I think a lot of these businesses probably would have worked. The idea was a little bit before their time, and they probably were undercapitalized. And second is that we did not hire our first employee until March of 2007. So for 2 years after launch, we continued to invest aggressively in building the technology, the infrastructure, and the back-end systems. So it wasn't like most businesses, marketing, revenue-led. We really knew that there wasn't going to be time later to figure that out, that we had to be absolutely the most efficient, you know, from day one.
So you really focused on the back end first, and you knew that, like, the small margin products were kind of the Trojan horse for the business.
Exactly.
You're still not making money from selling diapers,
right,
but you're
right.
Making money from selling clothes.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I think this is a good point, which is those first 2 years we were building the infrastructure, but we didn't hire our first employees, Mark said, and we didn't go out and raise capital outside of friends and family until also basically fall of 2006. So when we went out to go raise capital, we had 18 months of history. We had a model. We could do reasonable projections. And then I think maybe what was most important for the next several years thereafter was we hit our numbers every month. And
that was
with,
big, yeah.
With hitting our numbers every month, we built a lot of trust with our investors. We could then ask for more money to invest more in marketing or to make other investments in CapEx or to open up the warehouses.
At the end of the day, if you really want to pick one thing, it was just that. Because
yeah.
Without the capital, we wouldn't be here today, especially in a business that had sort of started with negative gross margins. To get capital is very challenging in that type of environment. So the only way we were able to do that was we kept doing exactly what we said.
Yeah.
Here's the long-term plan. This is step one, and we hit it. This is step two, and we hit it.
Incidentally, this is a side, but I'm sitting here in front of you guys, and just you seem like two characters from like The Office or something.
That doesn't sound very. Which characters now?
I'll take that.
You just seem very like two very unlikely guys to be starting a highly intensive logistical company.
You take
that as a compliment, Mark.
I'll take that.
But are you surprised ultimately that this is the type of company and the type of field that you have really honed in on? I mean, because now you have a number of e-commerce companies,
yeah.
From diapers.com to Yo-Yo and et cetera.
Right. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not necessarily surprised. I mean, I think a lot of our business is certainly the logistics and the technology, but at its core, it is about this customer, this mom that Mark was describing earlier that we focused on. There's all these little things, whether it's in our customer service department or in the way we organize our website or how we name our companies or in the advertising campaigns that we try to do that have some humor, and just making sure the experience is simple. So there's a lot of emotion that we try to bring to our brands in addition to the logistics, and I think we hired really well.
You mentioned humor. The tagline for diapers.com is "We deliver everything but the baby."
That's right. That's right.
Who came up with that?
I don't know. Do we?
Did you hire
someone? Oh, yeah, Mark came up with it. Mark got it.
There's so many things we've come up with. Did you forget who come up with what?
Well, we have another one, too, which is, because we don't have it on the website, but it's on our T-shirts, which is we're number one and number two. So I think that one sometimes I'll wear that T-shirt on the streets and people like that one.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Mark Lorre and Vineet Barrara, co-founders of the e-commerce company Quitsy. Quitsy is the parent company for sites including Diapers.com, a baby products retailer, Wag.com, which focuses on pet products, Soap.com, specializing in cleaning supplies, and Yoyo.com, an online toy retailer.
And you said that comment before about us being two characters from The Office. I think we're just real, you know, and I think the company itself is like that. And those are the kind of people that we look to hire.
We spend a lot of time when we interview folks, more so probably than anyone else, figuring out whether or not we're going to get along with them, whether they're going to treat people really well.
And there's one question we ask, and it's the only question that we ask, that if you don't answer it correctly, you don't get the job. And
we're going to give it away. Go ahead.
I got to give it to him.
Give it to him.
Would you rather be perceived in the workforce if you had a choice? Can only pick one of these. Perceived in the workforce as being a super smart asshole or a super nice idiot?
Oh, come on, guys.
Is it easy? It's easy?
Of course.
Wow. So maybe, what's the answer?
B.
Did she answer it right?
Yeah, she got it right.
Come on.
Lots of people don't answer it that way.
Yeah. You'd be surprised.
Just remember, you are then being perceived as an idiot. Like, it's not like, you know, sort of, you know, completely, you know, dumb.
Super nice idiot. Some people answer incorrectly, but there are a lot of people that really struggle with it. They just struggle with it, and that kind of tells you something, too. So,
back to 2007, you changed your name from 1-800-DIAPERS to finally diapers.com. What is the story behind that? How did you ultimately buy the URL?
Yeah, it wasn't easy. The guy that had it obviously didn't want to sell it for a long time. We made some big offers, really wasn't responding. So at the end of the day, we looked to our advisor and board member, Lynn Lodish, who's a professor at Wharton Business School. And he wrote a letter on Wharton letterhead from him, presenting the offer, and sent it FedEx. And it wasn't until that happened that the guy actually responded to the offer and we were able to negotiate a price.
What? How much was it? Are we talking hundreds of thousands of dollars?
Hundreds of thousands of dollars,
I want to talk about raising capital. You had, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars of seed capital initially. Is that from, you know, your father who was buying diapers? Yeah, on his credit card? Or
we self-funded a lot of it, and we obviously, and then we got some funding from friends and family, but we did self-fund a lot of it as well.
What was the experience like with venture capitalists? Ultimately, you raised about $70 million from firms including NEA, New Enterprise Associates, and Bessemer. Are there any interesting anecdotes there?
Let's say it got easier each round. The first round was very, very challenging. Like, this was at the end of 2006. We weren't able to get any of the really big VCs, so Bessemer, Excel, and NEA came in the B, C, and D rounds. The A round was really challenging, so we wind up looking to a lot of the angel investors that supported us at thepit.com. We sort of pieced that $4 million together.
One of the things I do remember was it was definitely easier later, except for 2008. After the meltdown.
Oh, yeah, after the meltdown in 08,
So we had a term sheet, we're ready to go, we were doing the diligence, and every day, you know, the market was down 100 points, down 200 points. And at some point, you know, we just didn't know whether the deal was going to close. And to Excel's credit, actually, and Samir Gandhi, who was on our board, you know, he honored the commitment because who knew what was going to happen at that point just in terms of the economy. But until you actually, the money's in the bank, you don't know whether that deal is going to close. And so he was West Coast time, and they were just sort of dilly-dallying at the end with sort of some signatures and stuff. And I think the wiring deadline was 3 o'clock, right? 3
yep,
o'clock
yep.
Pacific time. And, you know, and it was 2:55, and we thought, you know, money's going to come in, money's going to come in, money's coming in, and we were calling him. And at some point, it's like, you know, why don't we just wire the money tomorrow? I remember saying
that. Yeah.
We're like, no, you gotta wire it today. No, you gotta wire it today. It's nerve-wracking, you know, because you'd hear stories about people, you know, pulling the plug, even when you thought the deal was done.
I want to switch gears. I want to talk about Amazon. You have been obsessed with Jeff Bezos and Amazon. They've been, you know, both a role model and a fierce competitor up until they bought you in 2010. And one example of your kind of hyper-focus on them is one of you has read every 10K since 1996.
Well, I think they were, a decade ahead of us in terms of when they started that business. So there were a lot of learnings for us. Reading those 10Ks was incredibly valuable, as we read 10Ks of other retailers in the space, Toys R Us and Walmart and stuff, really just trying to understand the retail space. Neither one of us had any retail experience at all.
I remember one letter to shareholders. He writes these great letters to shareholders every year, and I think personally pens them. And one of them that we refer to often is, you know, they're a very analytical company, as we are, very data-driven, do a lot of things based on the math of what makes sense. But there are certain decisions, and in his example that he gives in his letter, he's talking about prices. And in every price test that they did, a short-term price test, you know, it never paid to cut prices. But then at times, you know, you just have to use judgment. And those are the hard decisions, the ones where you can't solve with math. And I think we also, you know, sort of that was something that I, at least, and Mark and I have sort of taken to heart too, which is we're an incredibly analytical company, but there's all of these decisions along the way that are very judgment-oriented, that you're not going to be able to use math. You just kind of have to use your instincts.
What's one really good example?
I think the colored boxes that we send out, for example, soap.com. If you ever to order from Soap, it's basically the outer corrugate box that goes to UPS is blue, green, red, and I think orange on each of the four sides, full color box. It costs probably an extra 30 cents to put that in color versus just a brown corrugate. But we believe in the power of marketing and those boxes sitting in the lobbies of New York City apartments and things.
I mean, the way we approach customer service itself, which is, you know, we invest a lot in it. It's expensive.
Handwritten notes, too. We send out about 200 handwritten notes per day out to customers. You know, any customer that has, you know, a bad experience or a complaint or things, and the customer service representatives will take the time to do that.
You know, ultimately, you were very focused on Amazon throughout the whole period leading up to their purchase. And at one point, they started paying attention to you. How did you know that they started paying attention to you?
Just to look at their prices.
Yeah, I think that's what happened, yeah.
I think, you know, you could just tell by looking at the prices. And, well, but then they launched Amazon Mom, I think, in 2010. 2009, I forget the years now. 2009,
it's 30% off diapers.
Yeah, and I think you know, we could tell at that point that yeah, there was a, you know, big player in the space. There was always a big player in the space, but it was going to be, you know, a little bit more challenging with those kinds of prices.
And when that started happening, were you like, let's put on the boxing gloves, or what was your emotional reaction to that?
Well, I think that the good thing, and even today, is that our customers, you know, we're not necessarily competing over the same customers. You know, we're different businesses. You know, I think there was certainly obviously some concern, but we were pretty resilient, you know, and I think what happened after that was I think, a testament to what we had built and also the differentiation that we had created from Amazon and a lot of the other folks in the marketplace, is that we were okay.
How did Amazon first approach you to buy you?
That's something we probably can't discuss, right? The specifics of that?
Right.
Just the whole process, I mean, because...
What is so secretive about that? Like,
if we told you, then you'd know.
I mean, I think at the end of it, it's a small world, actually, and there were introductions made, you know, from people who knew each other on our board and who were on their management team, and that was sort of the early discussions. And then I think lots of different things happened, I think, just to put it that way, in 2010.
Lots of different things. What do you mean?
Probably can't get into all the details of how that... the whole process, but
okay.
I think it's safe to say it was very unique circumstances that if we told you, you'd get it. So I think it's just one of those things that we don't know how to do it because it's very unique, it's confidential, and it's difficult to share.
Okay, I respect that.
It'd be fun to tell you this. It's a great story.
So we have some time left. Is there anything that I haven't asked that you think would be interesting to talk about? Any interesting anecdotes, such as how Amazon came to acquire you? What impact, if any, do your wives or the women in your life have on the business?
Well, Mark's sister, her name is Brooke, And Brooke is very, very famous with all the Quitsy employees because Brooke will tell us and Mark, and then Mark will tell everybody else, anytime, any product, anywhere on any of the websites is out of stock.
And any description that's wrong, and any picture that's wrong.
I mean,
and
Mark's sister, when Mark starts off with, I was talking to my sister, you know something bad is next. So my wife, probably unpopular actually with the rest of our employees, because usually it's a constructive criticism about what we could be doing better, or I couldn't find this, or just some sort of gentle improvement that we can be making.
What's an example?
For example, it was my kid's birthday the other day, and he wanted a certain type of car. And our objective and our mission at Yo-Yo, which is our toy store, is to carry everything. And so I will say, but we're not there yet. And so I'll say, hey guys, I just have to let you know that I'm one of the founders of this company, but I had to go to Amazon to buy, my son's birthday gift. But I'll refer to this. I'll say, my wife, she's checking Amazon, or some other site, as opposed to Yo-Yo.
Vinny, I'm just curious, your parents, are they immigrants?
Yes.
Where are your parents from?
So my parents are from India, from the northern part of India. They came
from Punjab?
They're actually, from the Punjab area. They were in what was previously Pakistan. So 1947, my dad and my mom actually emigrated to the Indian side during the riots, and then came over, went to London and then to the U.S. But with, we talk a lot about risk and where our backgrounds and why we started this company. And interestingly enough, my parents... sometimes, think that we shouldn't take all these risks or shouldn't start these companies. But the risks that they took were way more challenging and way more substantial than what we did by quitting our jobs. My parents' story, as so many immigrant stories, is probably part of how I approach life and risk and why we decided to do what we do.
What role do your parents play in the company now, if any?
Well, my dad will definitely Google every, he's Googling my brother, too. He Googles our company and likes to read all this stuff. But, unlike our wives, he doesn't really give any advice about how to run it, but he likes to read about it all the time. I know that.
Your brother, did he start a company?
No. He's the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. And so, he's in the press quite often as well. And so my dad always loves to read about him, too.
Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks a lot.
My guests have been Mark Laurie and Vinny Barrara, co-founders of Diapers.com. Coming up, we'll meet Lyndon Rive, co-founder of SolarCity. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Lyndon Rive, co-founder of SolarCity, a clean energy company that sells solar energy to consumers. SolarCity manufactures, finances, and installs solar panels for homes, schools, and businesses across the United States. SolarCity has installed solar panels for companies including Walmart, Intel, and eBay, among others. Lyndon founded the company with his brother Pete in 2006. SolarCity went public in December 2012. Lyndon is a former ballroom dance instructor and member of the U.S. national underwater hockey team. He is from Pretoria, South Africa. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you for having me. The ballroom dance instructor, how did you get that one?
Well, tell me how you became one.
When I was 12, actually, my aunt had a ballroom studio, and when you teach ballroom, the women's feet and the men's feet are the opposites of one another. So I helped her out with teaching out the men's feet.
In addition to the ballroom dancing, at 17, you started your first company. It was a homeopathics company selling remedies for arthritis and constipation, among other things. Do you still use homeopathic remedies in your life?
I don't use it as much, but I do focus on good eating. Mm-hmm. So make sure you get 2 green shakes every day, stay away from sweets, and do exercise, stay healthy. I still play underwater hockey.
How long are you able to hold your breath?
It's I can probably hold my breath about 2 minutes, but the trick about underwater hockey is repeating the breath holding for 30 minutes.
You joined the National Underwater Hockey Team in the United States after you came to the U.S. to start a software business with your brother, Russell. And it was your underwater hockey that actually helped you stay in the United States. Can you describe what happened there?
Both my wife and I are South African. I met my wife when I was 14 years old. So I came over first. I wanted to get the business established. Then she came over her visa expired before mine, and she figured out that there's a category called exceptional ability. It's an O visa.
Exceptional ability.
Any person that is exceptionally good at something, the U.S. wants you, but they can't discriminate. So my wife and I are actually really good at underwater hockey. She got her green card by being exceptionally good at underwater hockey. And then that's how I was able to stay in the country. The fact that I was employing 280 people, had $100 million company, I still couldn't get a green card. I was about to get deported. There's a lot of work there to be done if somebody who can play underwater hockey can stay in the country, but someone who starts a company cannot.
You ultimately sold the company to Dell in 2007. And before this time, you were noodling on what your next endeavor would be. And you came upon the idea for Solar City in the car going to Burning Man, which is in Nevada. How would you describe Burning Man?
It is a big party in the middle of the desert where there is nothing. So everybody brings everything with them. And then they leave, leaving no footprint. So that's the whole key.
And it was on your way to Burning Man when your cousin, the tech entrepreneur Elon Musk, came up with the idea to dabble in solar. Can you describe that car ride?
Elon and I, of course, we know each other as we are cousins. Our mothers are twins, and so we go back quite a bit. And he actually invested into Everdream, the software company. And so we actually started learning one another from a business side, not just from a personal side. So I was describing to Elon that I want to start a new business. And so it was his idea that, you know, he said, we'll get into the solar industry. And then I came back, discussed it with Peter, the second oldest brother. I'm the third one. And he instantly fell in love with the idea.
Could you describe how Solar City works?
The simple description of Solar City is that we are an energy company. We install the solar system in your house. We install it for free. You don't pay for the equipment. You don't pay for the installation. You don't pay for the service. The only thing you pay for is the electricity that the system produces. And you pay less for that electricity than what you would pay from the utility. So given the choice of paying more for dirty power or paying less for clean power, most of our customers, of course, prefer to pay less for clean power.
Since you are undertaking the whole installation process for consumers, it's a highly capital-intensive endeavor. And I want to talk about raising capital in the early days. You had the benefit of your cousin being on board, because it's kind of like by the guy, where venture capitalists will want to come on board with somebody as successful as he. Can you describe capital raising in the early days?
So remember, this is back in 2006. So Elon's success was well known back then, but it was primarily based on PayPal, not yet to be determined on SpaceX or Tesla. Elon absolutely did help, but it wasn't easy. A common question we would get is, how can we justify investing in this when there's already 4,000 other solar installers in the country at that time? The primary vision was describing what was wrong with the model. Everybody was selling solar equipment. They weren't selling solar energy. There has to be a whole transformation that occurs. You have to change out the energy infrastructure. You have to deliver renewable energy, but you're not going to do this if the consumer has to pay for the capital. So you have to just sell the electricity, the electrons.
And who were one or two investors that kind of served as critical allies for you?
So Draper Fisher and Jeveston goes back right to the beginning. They're the guys who gave me my first $2 million check when I was 22 years old. In the software company that manages PCs. But they've actually invested in every single financial round that I have raised, and that's like 30 or 40 different investments.
Here's a guy who sold homeopathic remedies, who's, you know, now selling solar. What to you has been or was most surprising about getting the company off the ground, more challenging than you had expected?
When I got into the business, I felt that the solar industry really had some anger towards the utility industry. And I was like, you know, that doesn't feel right. Like, the utilities can't be that bad. They can't be fighting you that much. Because all the media you see shows that the utility industry is very supportive of renewable energy. They do these campaigns of, you know, go green, be energy efficient. So clearly this is a misconception. Nope, it's not. Majority of the utility industry is fighting it tooth and nail.
And what's an example of your being face-to-face with the utility in a particular state?
A classic one would be California. When the solar industry started launching, the solar industry wanted a 0.25% net metering cap. So what a net metering cap is, it allows the homeowner to move the electricity back into the grid so the utility can sell it to the neighbor. And the utility industry said that if we allow a 0.25% cap, it will destroy the entire financial stability of the grid. When reality is actually, there's many benefits associated with generating electricity during peak periods during the day when the sun's shining on the panels and when most of the energy is needed.
What is an example of one or two utility companies that have been on the other side and have been friendly to your presence?
PG&E, as an example, a utility in California, one of the largest ones, they've invested over $300 million into our solar assets. Their previous CEO, Peter Darby, came from PacBow, and he told me that he saw what the cell phone did to the landline industry.
I want to speak briefly about tax credits. You rely heavily on them in terms of offering lower costs to your consumers. How do you navigate those issues?
Every energy sector has had significant tax credits, but the amount of credits that the solar industry gets is significantly less than what the fossil fuel industry gets. But even with that, we're going to get to a point where we can provide energy at a lower cost than fossil fuel can without credits. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be an unfair playing field, as they will still have their credits. We won't have ours, and we'll still beat them.
And why don't you have yours? Is it just the entrenchment of utility?
So you're dealing with entrenched industries that have been around for 50 to 100 years, and the subsidies go so deep. He has a classic subsidy that bugs me. One of our biggest costs in installing solar is the permitting. It's not that the permit itself is expensive. It's the time delay of getting the permit. Mm. So imagine you're driving on a highway, and then there was a stop, mm-hmm. and a dead stop where you actually have to get out of your car, the inspector looks in the car, and then you can go again. How big do you think the traffic jam would be? So that's what permitting does to the solar industry. It creates a traffic jam. The fossil fuel industry in California as well as in Texas, you don't need a permit. In Texas, an example, it's faster to get a fracking permit. And I'm not sure if you've seen a fracking facility. It's horrendous. Than it is to get a solar permit for your house.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Lyndon Rive, co-founder of SolarCity. SolarCity has installed systems for several hundred schools and universities, the U.S. military, and companies including Intel and eBay and Walmart. You're becoming more vertically integrated. Are you surprised by how vertically integrated you have to be in order to make the system as seamless and low cost as possible? Did you imagine that when you were first starting the company?
So when we launched the company, we thought, the first one thing that we'll do is we'll do the customer education and we'll do the customer acquisition, but we'll outsource the installation,
right,
and have somebody else do that. Terrible customer experience. So we quickly knew that we had to vertically integrate the installation business.
Which means your need for capital.
So we had to raise a lot of capital to be able to do that. But we took the harder path, but we knew that the harder path would yield a better result. Then the next one we integrated was our financing. So instead of going to a third party to finance the asset, and then the customer not knowing who they're working with, are they working with the installer or are they working with the financial institution? Who do they complain when there's a problem? So then we integrated the financials. So it's just one company you have to deal with. Then we looked at our cost and realized that, well, if we further vertically integrate the mounting hardware, we can improve the aesthetic issues. This mounting hardware that we bought improves the aesthetics dramatically. And now the next phase is integrating the actual manufacturing of the modules.
What companies did you look to in the early days that echoed what you were trying to do, not necessarily in the energy industry, but outside?
We wanted to create the experience no different than signing up for a cell phone plan or getting DirecTV. But there weren't many. In fact, this was a big criticism that we got in trying to raise capital, as there's not one single company that we could point to that has vertically integrated in our consumer business model.
I want to talk about the need to educate the consumer in the early days, because you don't have just a new service, but you're pioneering an industry. How did relationships with Home Depot or Best Buy help in that education?
education is still our biggest challenge. I've just witnessed this recently. A friend of mine knows that I'm in this business. He comes to me, he goes, just bought a house, I'm ready to get a solar system. What's the payback? And I almost wanted to punch him. I was like, how can you ask me what the payback is? I've been in this business for such a long time. You know I've been in this business. There is no payback. You just pay less for the electricity.
What did he mean by what's the payback?
Most consumers out there still think you have to buy the equipment, and then you look at what is the payback of the energy savings on the investment.
And you said, no, I'm installing for free.
The installation's free. The equipment's free. Everything's free. You just pay for the energy, and you pay less from the utility. That is our biggest challenge. So partnerships like Home Depot and Best Buy have helped tremendously. Because someone's going to Home Depot, they're not going there to buy solar. They're going there to go buy dirt or something for their house. Then we are there. The person walks by and we say, hey, would you like to save money on your utility bill? And they go, what are you talking about? Well, we can install the system for free and we sell you the energy at a lower rate than the utility. And then the next question is, I don't get it. What's the catch?
Well, how much pushback are you getting just because it's sort of not in my own backyard? Like, while I like the idea of solar, I don't want an ugly panel on my roof. Some might think it's pretty, but others might not.
Yeah, in new markets where solar is extremely new, it's not that solar is ugly. It's just new. Of course, I'm slightly biased. I think it's jewelry for your house. It's more good looking than any air conditioning units. It's more good looking than the power lines coming to your house. The power lines are ugly. So it's just that it's new. It's almost like the Prius. When the Prius first came out, it was an ugly-looking car. Now, I can say it because I actually bought a Prius shortly after it came out. But once it became understood that that's the shape and the practicality of the shape, it became one of the most successful cars out there.
Speaking of cars, you also own a Tesla, the electric car company founded by your cousin Elon. And I want to talk about Elon. I read somewhere that you've called him the Chosen One.
I've called him Neo. In The Matrix, if you watch the Matrix, Neo is the Chosen One. The reason for that is he sees all the zeros and ones. When working with Elon, he can quickly identify where the mistakes are and help us avoid those mistakes. And the way I often describe it is he will say, turn right into the pothole so that you can miss the invisible wall. And I'm like, but I don't want to hit the pothole. And he goes, well, you'd be way better off hitting the pothole than hitting the invisible wall. So then you just turn right, you hit the pothole, creates a little bump, and then in the rearview mirror, you see the invisible wall. And you go, wow, I'm glad I did not hit that invisible wall. But he just has the ability to see things that most cannot.
What was your view of him as you were growing up?
He was always extremely driven. A lot of the other students would beat him up for just being so smart. He was the first one to leave South Africa. He was the first one to start a software company, Zip2. It's often the company no one speaks about, but he sold it for $300 million.
What did it do?
It was almost a combination of MapQuest and Yellow Pages on the internet. He sold it to Compaq.
How about you? You know, you said that he was kind of a social outcast a little bit growing up. How about you?
I started my first company at 17, so I missed all the social activities. I was working 80 hours at a young age and going to high school. So, in fact, I didn't attend my last year of high school. I almost got expelled.
And your mom was pretty dogmatic about your working.
Yes, yeah, she's an incredible mother. Would you allow your kid to start a company in the last year of high school and then have them devote all their time on that company and not go to high school?
The homeopathic company.
Yeah, the homeopathic company. So it takes a certain parent to do that.
How much were you making from this company?
I was doing extremely well, but my principal wanted to expel me. I went to him and showed him my financials, and he realized that this would be more money than most people will ever make. And we made a deal that he would allow me to write the exams, but I don't have to go to school.
You're dyslexic, is that right?
I am. I struggle with reading and writing.
How has that helped you, do you think?
It's been a total pain to deal with. You just read contracts slower, so it's a little annoying sometimes.
So you feel like it's been more of a detriment?
The help is, you know, often you can either be viewed as a victim and go, okay, this is the reason why I have failed, Or you can just go, okay, I'm not good at that. What are all the things that I can do to supplement that weakness? I knew that academics is not something I'd strive in, so that's why I started my first company at 17. It allowed me to develop a strong sense for business. It's allowed me to develop a good way of communicating, because I rely on oral communication a lot more than writing communication. It has allowed me to persevere through very, very difficult times. I think it has helped me.
Yeah.
But given the choice of having or not having, I'd prefer not to have it.
You have two boys. How do you explain to them what you do for a living?
So it's tough. But the area that we focused on is saving the planet. So they call me Captain Planet. They're trying to justify the reasons why I'm not always at home. The other day, my kid came to me and said, "Ryan's dad's often at home. Why aren't you at home?" And I have to explain to him that, you know, I'm trying to save the planet.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Captain Planet Lyndon Rive, co-founder of SolarCity.
If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.